Right, let's get started. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to our 234th edition of Europe Calling. My name is Maximilian Fries. I'm the Managing Director of Europe Calling, and as always, I will be your host this evening. I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to our guests for today's discussion, and I'll introduce them in more detail in a moment. So before we start, here's a few quick announcements. We'll be speaking a mix of German and English. If you need any assistance, we have two wonderful interpreters who are very happy to work for you. You can select your preferred language under the small globe icon and the control bar. So, as always, with Europe Calling, you are welcome to ask questions and rate the questions asked by others. I'm using Slido for this. You can see the link in the chat. Feel free to ask your burning questions there and rate the question of others. And this is the only way you can actually ask those burning questions you're interested in, given that we have about 3,000 registrations for tonight's webinar. Very important. Please add your name. It's so much nicer if you don't have to keep saying anonymous user. So here's the link. I put it in the chat shortly, and as always, Europe Calling will be recorded and then be put online. Actually, it is online already, live on YouTube, and will be following as a podcast, so please keep this in mind when asking questions online. So much for housekeeping announcement. So I'd like to start today's webinar with a quote from Emmanuel Macron, the French president. He was at the British Parliament a fortnight ago, and he said something about the issues that we're talking about today. Let me give this as a starter. He said something like, what is at stake in Europe today is the defense of democratic models in the midst of foreign interference, information manipulation, and the domination of mind by negative emotions and social media addiction. Well, he did say that in English with a French accent. It probably sounded a lot nicer. But anyway, I think this is a great quote to start our webinar. So, having said this, let's welcome our first guest, Nina Jankowicz, U.S. researcher and author. In 2022, the then U.S. President Joe Biden appointed her head of his new agency, the Disinformation Governance Board. And currently, Nina is the co-founder and the CEO of the American Sunlight Project, a nonprofit organization focused on countering disinformation. So we're very, very happy to have you here today. Off you go.
Thank you so much, everyone. It's really lovely to be with so many participants across Europe. I have spent a lot of time in Europe. I have researched your responses to countering disinformation, and it's just a delight to be with you today. So I've been asked to answer the question, what's the role of disinformation and propaganda, and how do they influence politics? What do they do to our democracy? And I thought I'd first start with defining disinformation, because despite the fact that we are now more than 8 years into this disinformation crisis, when the West finally woke up to the threat of disinformation, there are still people who use these terms very inaccurately, or use them in ways that are, you know, easily mixed with other terms that actually have different meanings. And when we're talking about information, it's important that we are precise, because the purveyors of disinformation, the people who use it for power and for profit, play fast and loose with definitions and often are quite imprecise with how they address this topic. So disinformation is the use of false or misleading information with malign intent. They can be broader parts of influence operations run by foreign governments, but they can also exist in the domestic context, right? And I think the most important thing to understand about disinformation and broadly about influence operations is that without a shared reality, without shared facts, our democracy can't function. When you have people going to the ballot box who are voting on a reality that does not exist, then we end up in polarized situations like what my own country is experiencing now in the second Trump administration, where folks are just diametrically opposed to one another, not agreeing on very much, can't even agree on the basic facts of the threats to our country right now. It's a very, very serious situation. Now, I would be remiss to say that disinformation is something that is, let me rephrase that, that disinformation is the cause of all of these problems, or that all of this is coming from foreign manipulation. It's not. The most successful disinformation that I've found in my career, and you can see my book is right here, How to Lose the Information War, looks at six different countries in Central and Eastern Europe and the way that they responded to disinformation before the West even recognized it was a threat. One of the most important things I learned when researching that book was that the most potent disinformation, the most successful disinformation, has a kernel of truth to it. It is not fully whole cloth fabricated falsehoods. It is often stuff that plays on people's real grievances and worries about society. So if you look at the types of things that we saw coming out of the Russian Internet Research Agency back in 2016, many of them will seem familiar today because they're still the hot button issues that our societies are grappling with. Things like immigration, things like in the United States, gun rights. These are issues that we tend to find a lot of passion about. And when there is passion, when there is emotion, then the facts can get very easily twisted. The Russians continue to use, foreign information manipulation and interference, FIMI, or just influence operations, if you'd like to say it more simply. They continue to do this, but they are evolving their tactics. Now, first, one of the most important things that has changed since 2016, of course, is the way that social media platforms have morphed over the 8 years. I would say around 2020 was the peak of social media platforms responding to harmful content online, whether that was disinformation, hate speech, or otherwise. And we've really fallen off a cliff since then. As you are likely aware, the social media platforms are now all but in bed with President Trump, sitting in the front row behind him during his inauguration, in front of even members of the Trump cabinet. They have really changed their policies on trust and safety and content moderation to be more loose when it comes to disinformation and other harmful content. And that means that we're seeing a lot less action taken across the board toward domestic information, certainly, but also toward foreign disinformation. And that opens up a lot of possibilities for our foreign adversaries, not just Russia, but China, Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, et cetera. Russia continues to be, I think, ahead of the curve when it comes to disinformation, iterating on a lot of openings in society that may not have existed before. And one of the ways that they're doing that is by using artificial intelligence, which everyone loves to talk about. So I'd be remiss not to mention it today. My organization, the American Sunlight Project, did a little bit of digging into a network called Pravda, which was first attributed by the French agency Viginum last fall, I believe, as a Russian operation. And one of my researchers was looking at Pravda, which is this collection of content aggregation websites that takes Russian propaganda and reposts it on a bunch of identical websites across the web in different languages. And she was thinking to herself, why is it that this network is so poor? They're really bad at what they do. These websites are not easily used by humans. They don't have working search bars. The scroll is broken. They look like they're from 1999. They don't have a big social media presence. What could be going on here? And what she ended up doing was calculating the amount of content that these networks were pushing out in 1 year. And by our estimate, it's over 3.6 million pieces of content per year that Pravda is pushing out on these low-quality websites. And her hypothesis, which has now since been confirmed, is that the Pravda network is pushing out all of this content in order to groom large language models like ChatGPT into spitting out Russian propaganda. They are flooding the zone with a bunch of bad content that is, hateful and misleading on the one hand, and just completely fabricated on the other hand. A lot of it is about Ukraine. And so we found recently that even when you ask ChatGPT's sophisticated reasoning models, the ones that you have to pay more money for in order to answer questions about Ukraine, they're still citing Pravda, even though these reasoning models know that Pravda is a Russian propaganda network. So that's one way our foreign friends are attempting to influence us with AI. The other way that I think is important to point out is back in the early days of online influence operations coming from Russia, we used to be able to pick them up from interesting linguistic cues, right? Especially in English, you know, they would drop articles, idioms would be used incorrectly. You could tell Google Translate was being used. With large language models, you can create pitch perfect, idiomatically and grammatically correct content that is, you know, tailored to the most vulnerable and specific audiences in the click of a button, right? It is much easier to create that stuff, and you can create compelling visual content to go along with it. It used to take quite an army of people to do that, and now all you need is a subscription to a large language model. So that's the current situation with foreign interference. Of course, you know, I think as an American right now, foreign interference is not my main concern because disinformation has become the policy of this current administration in the United States. They are, as you all know, bullying the European Union into watering down or not enforcing the Digital Services Act, among other legislation that would curb disinformation, threatening the EU with tariffs over it, you know, making and implementing its own laws. And that sort of behavior is what led me to, when I was in European Parliament in April, to call the United States an autocracy. Any of the behaviors that we're seeing coming from this administration, from, you know, arresting people for writing op-eds, those who are legally in the country, students usually, to bullying sovereign nations and to not enforcing their own laws against American companies. I mean, in a horse by any other name would be called an autocratic horse, right? So that's where we are. I think it is important to recognize now that Russia, China, Iran are getting a lot of help from the Trump administration, which again, is very regularly bending the truth to put it diplomatically, and outright lying to put it undiplomatically. The other thing that I will point out is that the Trump administration has dismantled the US response to counter disinformation, both through the effort that I was involved in, that Maximilian mentioned in my introduction, which was widely lied about. And as a result, I received a lot of threats, harassment still to this day. I get threats and harassment because of the lies that were told about me and my work in the Biden administration. And that was in 2022, before this administration was even in office. Now we've seen the dominoes fall one by one. The Global Engagement Center at the State Department, which attributed so many of the foreign influence operations that we've heard about over the past few years, it's gone. Its employees have been fired summarily by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who has lied and said that those folks who were dedicated civil servants, subject matter experts, were censoring people. It's just totally untrue. Other entities, including the FBI's Foreign Influence Task Force, have been disbanded. We've seen similar things happen across the federal government, and organizations like mine and other organizations in the United States that focused on countering disinformation and bringing these threats to the public are under legal threat. We are having a hard time getting funding because so many of the philanthropies and our donors are now scared to associate with folks who are doing work in this space. So I think the impact, to bring it back to the opening question, the impact of disinformation on democracy is that it leaves us confused about what is true and what is not. It puts researchers, truth tellers, journalists under threat because they are characterized in ways that are not true. And it leaves our institutions open to interference from foreign entities, often helped by some governments that might be, you know, welcoming to this, whether they recognize that they're doing that overtly or not. But I don't want to leave you on too pessimistic of a note. As I wrap up, I've always been an optimist in this space. If you ever see me totally opt out of you know, engaging in the counter disinformation space, you will know I've lost my optimism. But as it stands, I still get up every day and I do this work because I've seen, no matter where I travel, small towns in Europe to small towns here in the United States, in the Midwest, in the West, I've connected with audiences all around the world who may not be experts on this topic, but they want to be empowered to navigate this very confusing information environment in a way that serves them, right? They don't necessarily know all the ins and outs of how algorithms work or how the media environment works in the social media age, but we can teach them. And one of the most inspiring things that I saw in my research in Central and Eastern Europe back before the pandemic was that even smaller, less affluent countries were investing in teaching people how to navigate today's information environment. And that doesn't mean saying this media outlet is good, this media outlet is bad. It means telling them about how advertising online works. It means telling them about the signs they can look for related to emotional manipulation. If you're feeling emotional when you're reading a piece of content, there's a good chance you're being manipulated. That one heuristic really helps people navigate. And one other final thing that I do, and I do this with my graduate students at Syracuse University as well. These are all folks going into careers in public policy. They're all highly professional people from, around 25 to 40 years old. And still, when I have them track their information consumption over a 24-hour period, they are shocked at the degree to which their information consumption is passive. We all need to get a lot more deliberate about our information consumption, recognizing that if you're getting something from a push alert or a notification, it's being driven to you for a reason, and that might be making the tech companies more money, right? So how can we return that deliberation to our information consumption, both in what we are consuming and what we're sharing as well? We all need to take care before we share. And you all, this wonderful audience, are taking a great first step by being at an educational webinar like this, by interacting with me and my very distinguished co-speakers, and I'm thrilled to be here today. So looking forward to your questions, and thanks again for having me.
Nina, ganz herzlichen Dank dafür.
Thank you so much, Nina. That was great. Loved it. You touched on so many issues and we'll be enlarging upon them. But just a few things I need to point out before we continue. So those of you, if you're listening to both English or German and you don't need interpretation, what you can do is you can go to YouTube. You got the same seminar and the original. So maybe we can let a few people in here into the webinar that do need translation. So those of you who are fine with both English and German in the original, you might want to turn to YouTube. So I'm not trying to kick anybody out, but so much for a technical announcement. My colleague here does a beautiful job, Amelie. Now let me introduce Nathaniel Leminski, State Minister for Federal and European Affairs and the Media. So that's the German region of North Rhine-Westphalia and head of the State Chancellery, member of the German CDU for a long time. He was active in this field, also in the former state government. This is something you might not know. North Rhine-Westphalia is the largest federal state within Germany. We have a government that's so-called black-green government, that is CDU, the Christian Democrats, and the Greens. And we got beautifully reflected that in this panel with Alexandra Green and Nathaniel Black. So off you go. Thank you very much, Mr. Fritz, Ms. Jankowicz, Ms. Giese, all our guests in the chat. I'm very happy to be on board. Now, first of all, let me say I'm really impressed how many people have joined the webinar. Well, as a member of the European Parliament and as European politicians, this is what we always wish for. Now, how many people joined the debate? This is something what we need. This is a good basis to strengthen our European values and to have our European public informed. Of course, it's very important given the subject that we're discussing tonight, which is the attack on our public with disinformation. So thank you very much. It's great to hear about what's happened in the United States. Nina Jankovic and Ms. Giese, you and I, we've had debates before. Very happy to be amongst the team here. And I'm looking forward to listening to what you have to say later. Now, the debate about this information, it just shows that there's a danger from inside and outside. And this shows a clear impact. So we have campaigns, you know, foreign interference, foreign campaigns trying to manipulate the result of the German parliamentary elections. Just recently we had this example, or just spreading lies, and that way make people no longer trust in democratic institutions. And then we see that platforms refuse to take over responsibility, to take over ownership. They don't really care what's happening to the content they have on offer. So looking at our democratic understanding of freedom, well, we see there are limits, and we see there are major attacks on our freedom. Often what people do is they point to the different culture of debate in the United States and in Europe. So if we want to take a closer look, we'll find that, yes, there is a different understanding of freedom, individual freedom especially, but also, you know, what's the relationship between citizens and the state, citizens and the government. So actually, I went to school in the United States. I was very lucky there to get a peek into American culture, and then I went back to the States during my professional training, and you will quickly see that in the States, a large part of society is of the opinion that the state should interfere as little as possible. And their interpretation of freedom and freedom of opinion is a very large concept. Especially when it comes to the freedom of speech and freedom of opinion, given today's administration. And this has led to reproaches heard like censorship and no lies on the net in Europe. In Europe, however, we have the tradition of thinking that the state will protect us, and freedom will always mean that we should respect other people's rights and to protect them. So this way, I believe that freedom and responsibility, freedom and ownership, are much closer friends, you know, they're linked. And that's an important aspect when we're discussing fake news, disinformation, what we see happening on platforms. And I think this is quite a contradiction or an opposite, really. I'm a friend of the States, and I'm, you know, all for close transatlantic ties. I find that really hard to swallow. So actually, we're not thinking in the same way when talking about values. So when we're now asking the question, what's our answer in Germany, in Europe? We should ask the question, what kind of contact is against the law, actually? And what kind of contact is acceptable, tolerable, even if we might not like it? So looking at the legal tradition of freedom of opinion, we find it is of extreme importance. But at the same time, we, even when grinding our teeth, we have to accept some content that we might not always like, given its moral truth. And we have to be very clear about it. You know, we have to be clear and concise when we take action. Recently, we have seen digitalization undertaking a very fast development. So any kind of regulation, and you always have to ask the question, yes or no regulation, any regulation must survive a stress test and must show itself resilient against those who believe in conspiracy theories. So, you know, if the regulation still survives, that's a good thing, and it always has to stick to a number of rules. One thing is sure, on the internet, We have the same rule of law, the same rules as we have offline. So what does that mean? Looking back in recent decades, looking at our cultural tradition, the legal framework, we have developed a new framework. What do I mean by this? Let's say somebody says Holocaust never happened, somebody who threatens violence, they cannot point to their basic right, the freedom of speech. No, this is a criminal offense. If you put this on paper, black and white like that, and also explain that when in debate with our US-American counterparts, we see that they have a much narrower perspective, like the First Amendment, they would say this is the law. So if this is true for the street, it also has to be true for the internet. Now, content spread by disinformation campaigns, first of all, as a content, they are admissible, even though we refuse to accept them, we're not happy about them. However, what we should not accept is the fact that the public is manipulated and facts are manipulated. So from my perspective, I think the state needs to come in. And this is actually the lever that we need to use when it comes to disinformation, fake accounts, masses of them, bots being used all over the place. So this gives an illusion of people accepting the content, but this is actually not the case. So it's actually distorting reality. And this is also the reason why I'm saying that it's no longer about the freedom of speech. It's actually the contrary. It limits our freedom of speech. Having to deal with those bots, we have to roll up our sleeves and take action. Because it's not just about having a debate or admitting discussions like of right extremist groups, for example. It's actually a hybrid warfare form. So let me give you a concrete example of the debate. Like we have today, it's the right moment to discuss it. When I was in Brussels for the past weeks, I heard people who were very upset, very angry about J.D. Vance's speech, say that, well, okay, European regulation in that field under the negotiations of tariffs, it's not that important. That's what I hear them say. And I just have to say, no, don't go down that route, because this is the core of European legitimacy, linking freedom to ownership. So let's be very clear here. Tariffs, looking at what the Trump administration wrote, this is very bad news for our economy. That is clear. But at the same time, it's unacceptable that we are, happy to accept values undermined, like our freedom, talking to ourselves more than our American friends here, given this Jobs news. So doing something that leads to de-escalation with the Trump administration, that would have dire consequences in our society, in our culture. I think we shouldn't forget that we have a market power of more than 400 million clients, customers. So if in the end the Trump administration is only looking at money, only looking at currency and the number of clients, we just have to play that card, the Trump card, so to say. But first of all, we have to stick to our guns, we have to stick to our positions. Now, when we're leading this debate and we see that there's pressure exerted, we shouldn't be worried in the sense that we couldn't defend ourselves. Of course, given the power of the big tech enterprises. It might make you shy, but no, we do have various means at our hands. In Europe, given the international comparison, we have a great media landscape. And of course, we feel the economic pressure in terms of digitalization and artificial intelligence. I'm not doubting that. So we have to take a closer look at solutions. What can we do to keep our diverse media landscape alive and blooming? In Germany, there is a digital fee in the debate, and this is necessary, I believe, because the platforms who use the content in Europe, well, they will have to pay the bill. And this would be one of the ways to keep our diversity alive. Looking at the existing regulation, we have talked about the Digital Services Act. We have the first procedures up and running, and we have to follow them through until the end to show that it's not a toothless tiger. So when you keep up the debates with the platforms, that's a good thing to start with. You know, we should continue the debates, but also make sure that regulations are enforced. In Germany, it's the federal states that are responsible for enforcement, and it's not just the DSA and the artificial intelligence rules that we enforce as the lenders, the federal states. We do so together with the federal state of Germany and also with a number of counterparts who have the same opinion in the European Union. I'm looking forward to hearing from Alexandra Gese. Thank you.
Thank you very much also for this important information about Europe. Alexandra Gese will take that up, I'm sure. The information, all those who understand English and German, you can use the YouTube channel to listen to the original so that we have a bit more space. Now I would like to hand over to Alexandra Gese. Many of you know her. She is the digital policy expert for the Green EFA parliamentary group in the European Parliament. She has co-negotiated the EU Digital Services Act. We have talked about that already. She was in the room when it happened, and we are very happy, Alexandra, that you participate. Thank you very much, Max, for your introduction, and a very nice evening, and hello to each and everyone and who wants to discuss with us. Nina, I'm very pleased that you are here. I'm in Cambridge, by the way, at the moment, where we met. And here at the business school, that's where I am, because disinformation is also a systemic threat for the economy. Mr. Leminski, I'm also very happy that you are here, overarching from other parties. And I completely share your statements that we can now not stop important rules to enforce because the US are threatening with tariffs, because disinformation is spread more quickly than proper information. And this is a threat not only for our democracy, but also for our economy. This is a great threat and danger. I would like to say we are not talking about individual disinformation campaign, national ones or foreign ones. Our intention is the concept of facts, the concept of scientific evidence, the concept of truth needs to be or is questioned as such. And we find out that people cannot differentiate anymore. This is something we see now in the US. There are attacks onto the universities. Harvard, for example, is only the top of the iceberg. It is visible because of the attacks to scientists. The censorship shows that many topics cannot be researched anymore because the subsidy is gone. Certain facts cannot be collected anymore, for example, about the weather phenomena. And one can think about what that means for the situation. It is a danger for our democracy that facts are not made accessible anymore. Why has disinformation become so successful? This was also already happening during the times of the Soviet Union, between the US and the Soviet Union. One wanted to influence, but that was not so successful. It has to do with the algorithms. They prefer disinformation. We have explained it before here during our discussions at Europe Calling, but I know that a lot of people have not heard about it, even highly educated one. That's why I want to explain again. Disinformation is currently spread to more people than the actual true information in the social media. The press is still a counterbalance, but this is also influenced more and more by this mechanism. What is the reason for that? This has to do with the fact that social media companies, of course, want to optimize their profits. And they do that by showing advertisement. And therefore, they are interested in keeping us on their platform as long as possible. We stay longer on that platform if we interact with certain content, if we share a post, if we comment a post. And we do that more often when we have negative emotions like anger. This has to do with the fact that these emotions are important for acting in nature. For example, a wild animal is approaching you. These are the instincts we have since we became human beings. And this used to be a very useful reaction. And this is used in the internet as a mechanism which is actually promoting disinformation, because the algorithms say this tweet, this post is sent to more people and therefore it is spread more widely. And this is also an approach for politics to work more with negative emotions, because you are more visible and you are invited into talk shows. This is a mechanism which we can interrupt. And now I would like to talk about the solutions. We have the Digital Services Act on European level. We can fight against that. In the US, it's much more difficult because we have a legal basis to fight against this. There's Article 34 saying if there are systemic risks which are triggered by the platform, for example, for basic human rights, for public health, but also for elections and for public processes, i.e. for democracy, the Commission can start investigations, can check what is the systemic risk, and the Commission can take steps to counteract that and to abolish that. And I think we all agree the fact that disinformation is being spread more in the social media than proper information is a systemic problem. This is also written like that in a similar way in the coalition agreement, and many people in our country and in Europe share this opinion, and therefore investigations need to be started, and they will probably come to the conclusion that this ranking, this is what I explained, if you click something, or TikTok, if they watch the video for a longer time, this has been shown to more people. This is the main mechanism which promotes this widespread of disinformation. This also means that any influencer which starts to spread conspiracy theories or fake news is spread more widely than press who needs to adhere to the facts and who is serious. And this is also a problem that means for our media landscape in the long run, because they are more and more reliant on money they get from the internet. The European Commission could simply, without any parliamentary decision, we already have the act, could start these investigations in order to stop that mechanism and request from the platform to replace this algorithm by another one which takes into consideration the conscious decision we take as users. And that doesn't mean that I share a video because I'm afraid about it, or that means I can say upfront, I would like to see these media I would like to see content which is written by serious journalists, or I would like to see something about my hobbies, and this is 1, 2, and 3, and then I can make my choice. This is another possibility. And this will increase our freedom of expression enormously. This means this content doesn't come from Zuckerberg or Elon Musk or from the Chinese government. No, we ourselves are choosing what is of interest to us. And if you would like to support this solution, you can sign a petition. Petition is called Freedom for Facts, is live since yesterday. And you can support exactly what I explained just now. Facts should have a real chance to reach people, because freedom of expression includes the right to be informed, to get information, to gather information at first view on the internet, and not lies or propaganda, disinformation. Please sign our petition. Max, I'm sure you will publish the link in the chat. This is your chance really to contribute, to spread this information. We can find a relatively easy solution. We simply have to do it. The European Commission has to do it, can do it. And the federal states, of course, can commit themselves, because they have quite huge competences as far as the media are concerned, and the German Bundesrat, I could imagine, takes a decision and asks the German government to support exactly that at the European Commission. And I have already sent this to several governments, and the German government, for example, could work together with the French government, for example. We heard in the introduction that President Macron has already said something about it. And I could imagine quite a good cooperation between Germany and France, also with Poland, to really ask the Commission to do something. Why is the Commission not doing that? Mr. Leminski has already said so. She's afraid what the US might do. Trump threatens with even higher tariffs. I mean, every day we have new tariffs appearing on the horizon. He does not want Europe to introduce digital tariffs. He wants that those violating our digital laws from the US do not have to pay a punishment. Just imagine the German government would demand exactly that in the US for German companies. And any regulation that would mean this would be a censorship. And I am of the opinion we really have to control this freedom of expression. When it was introduced in 21, it says it must not damage the other or influence his freedom of expression. I would go even further, and I would be more expressive, and I would say if tech billionaires like Zuckerberg or Musk can decide via algorithms that we receive a majority of disinformation and content full of fear. That means all the other content is being suppressed, and we have quite good data about that. And this has nothing to do with freedom of expression. This is the freedom of expression of a small number of billionaires in the US, but not our freedom of expression. They suppress our freedom of expression. Secondly, hatred and incitement are used against women, against adversaries, against political adversaries. And this manipulates the political space, which means many people do not want to participate in the political public discourse anymore. And this has nothing to do whatsoever with freedom of expression anymore. This is something we need to fight against. This was one approach. I would like to say more, but I don't have more.
Yeah, vielen, vielen Dank. Oh, so yes, we are switching to English, I forgot, so I need to switch to English as well. So thanks so much. We have many, many questions, 50 at the moment, with a lot of likes on them, and we also have some hands. So how are we going to do this Q&A? So I'm trying to get as many questions from the audience in, and then here on the panel, you can use your hand up button, or you just show your hand. I will also see your hand if you want to say something. Not everyone has to talk to all the points. I might give some questions specifically to people, but we can be a bit interactive here in the room and you can take your space. I mean, there are many, many topics we have. I heard, you know, the issue of press and media. We spoke about algorithms, and we also get many questions about, you know, about what something that Nina also pointed out to is about, you know, teaching people, education, about how those mechanisms work as well. So this is one point I want to talk to you about as well. Also, you know, when it comes to when it comes to big tech and you know, the fight back that Mr. Leminski was referring to, that we are not batching down. It's really important, but I really want to know something more about this, and the audience as well. So, but I want to start with the top question, and this is a question for Mr. Leminski, and I think I will also want to widen it a bit. So, and of course, you know, if you follow the German discussion, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, the selection of the Supreme Court justices at the moment. There was a right-wing campaign against one of the candidates, also a disinformation campaign. She was yesterday in a big German talk show, and so one of our guests, and this is actually the top questions with a lot of distance. The person asks, in this smear campaign against this Posios Gerstorf, which is the justice fueled by far-right neos, relevant and also relevant CDU representatives that are actively involved in downplaying and remaining silent on the matter. How can you currently credibly stand for the protection of democracy against this information? This is the top caption. I want to give this to Mr. Leminski as kind of the question on the topic, but I would also like to open it, because I think the question is also, how do political parties and the political actors deal in a climate of misinformation, right? Because we are in this climate. This is very prolific. So how should political parties deal with it? So maybe Mr. Leminski first, and then I want to open up to Nina and Alexandra. Are you muted, Mr. Leminski?
Okay, here you go. Well, to start with this question, which indeed is heavily discussed in German politics right now, we first have to acknowledge that, as I said, in a free democracy, you have the right to criticize the positions for people being nominated for public offices. And there has been criticism of the positions of this judge, not just from the far right networks. And so we should be cautious in discriminating every criticism as a result or as a product of far-right disinformation or far-right media networks. Because if we do this, people who criticize that out of any conviction, let's take Christian convictions or others, they feel themselves being presented as lunatics, and in the end they will end up criticizing that they cannot speak open anymore in our society. So I really would urge all of us to keep the freedom of the discussion by also acknowledging and allowing that there are different positions on the questions which were discussed on all of this. At the same time, we also have to be realistic that, of course, you can see that there have been actions taken by far right networks to create or to organize some kind of hunt against this judge. So I can fully understand that he criticizes the way she was confronted by many people from the far right networks, and also others who took over that kind of argumentation and criticism. So I hope that in the end we will find back to a way of discussing issues like that in a decent way. And we can see that if we don't do this, in the end, it will hurt institutions which are very important, which are crucial for the functioning of a democracy. And that's something we as politicians have to be a role model for. And so I try, and our state government tries to do it itself, so that we can warn others not to do it differently.
Thank you very much. Maybe just to keep, you know, with a bit of a German focus, so I take Alexandra first and then open up to Nina to kind of the view of kind of the extreme example that we have in the US right now, which I think is even pushing this a bit forward. But I think, you know, without probably knowing the details of it, this sounds probably very familiar to Nina. Alexandra.
Yes, thank you. I agree with Mr. Leminski on that we should have that conversation in a decent way. I disagree with the fact that this is what happened. I think this is really an example of a MAGA style, a Jim Jordan style witch hunt against one specific person, which used important pieces of disinformation, like, for example, stating that she was in favor of a total right to abortion until up to the 9th month, which is a very unpopular decision. Opinion in Germany. And this was a total lie, because what her paper actually said is a very differentiated and a very nuanced approach, which is exactly what 74% of Germans say that is the position they agree on. And that was not in the media until she made that TV statement. There were also allegations that she had copied part of her PhD thesis, which are clearly untrue, because the paper she seems to have copied from came out 3 years later. And there's a very strongly gendered aspect to this. You know, it's a lot easier to get so hard against a woman than a man. So I think this is really a typical example of a witch hunt. And it's a typical example of how quickly you can turn things around and create damage, even if now the decision has been postponed, but the damage is done anyway. So I think this is exactly what should not happen in this case. And I think this is a very serious, serious precedent for German institutions, who used to be a little bit boring, but that was a good thing. The one thing there where I would agree, and what we should avoid, is we shouldn't be shaming people. I think that is a point where we have, like, on the progressive side to criticize a little bit ourselves. Because one thing that is very much ignored around the whole disinformation issue is the role of emotions. So why do people believe disinformation? Because there's a lot of emotions. I don't have the time to go into this, but emotions like shame and pride and the want to control things in the poly crisis, I think that are very, very important emotions. And we should be very, very careful on how we communicate and who we are inclusive with, who we try to exclude from space. So also on our side, I think this is really important to take into account. I don't think it's relevant in this specific case around the constitutional judge, but on a general level, I think this is really one issue that progressive have was communication. They don't, we don't understand the role of emotions and not shaming people while stating that other people have rights. And this is something we need to look into.
Thank you. Giving that to Nina.
This is a really interesting case, and you're right that I hear a lot of echoes and the rhetoric that we've seen coming from the MAGA movement here in the United States. One of the things that's been most frustrating to me throughout the past 8 years has been the embrace of disinformation as a political tactic. Now, people will say that politicians have always lied, right? But there's a difference between campaign statements that are maybe a little bit misleading and the full scale directed at the most vulnerable, very, you know, pinpointed disinformation that we see being emboldened by the social media platforms today. And I have been frustrated both with individuals within the Republican Party who stood strong against then candidate Trump back in 2015 and 2016, even to people who criticized him during his first term, who are now in his cabinet, to the Democrats as well, for not standing strong enough against the type of manipulation that we're seeing here. And since it's relevant to the conversation about this judge, against gendered violence as well. There was an example not too long ago when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was called, excuse me for cursing, but a bitch by one of her Republican colleagues on the steps of the Capitol. And there was a censure vote and he was not censured. If this is the way that politicians are behaving, and of course that behavior is endorsed by the commander in chief, if disinformation becomes a part of a normal part of political warfare, let's call it, then our democracy cannot function, as I mentioned before. It cannot function. There, politicians will lose trust, and you know, trust for politicians is already in the tank. People will start to behave worse, and we're seeing that not only in how people treat each other online, but also in real extrajudicial physical violence here in the United States. Just a month ago, a state representative in Minnesota was shot dead along with her husband and her golden retriever dog because of her stance on things like women's rights and access to healthcare. And as someone who's been threatened online, I think about that a lot. I think about that a lot. And this is not the only incident of political violence that we've seen or that we're going to see. And so my point is, I think it is really important for politicians to stand strong and say, you know what, we recognize that disinformation knows no political party, that when the other side uses it against us one day, you know, we cannot use it against them, because it, what comes around goes around, as we say in English, right? And that it is just a scourge to our systems functioning as they are meant to function. We need our politicians, although that this, you know, from time immemorial, politicians have not necessarily been always the paragon of behavior, but that is what we should, I'm thinking of some Roman emperors, not even recent politicians, but we should have politicians that, you know, inspire the best in their populations. And that starts with how we treat each other as human beings and, you know, falling through on our actions and making sure that lying is not taking place. And it is of grave disappointment to me that the Democrats have not found a way to call this out, but also not engage in it themselves. There were some behaviors in the campaign last year that I thought were too much fighting fire with fire and led us to a very a difficult place as a party. And so now I'm kind of hands off of all of that, but that's my message to any politicians that might be listening.
I want to take that on and move a bit to the solutions part of it. So what are the extra strategies to combat that? And we actually have a question in the chat actually from Portugal, which I always love to have questions that are, you know, in English, not from Germany. And Maria João Nogueira from Portugal asked, shouldn't the Finnish strategy from Finland of teaching critical thinking from a very young age in schools be adopted everywhere? And isn't education the only real way to combat and mitigate disinformation? And I want to combine this with something that is actually happening right now. We have in Europe, we have a very big discussion, and in other parts as well, but the European Parliament, the Commission, about age restrictions. So, you know, there are obviously the two options. Do you teach people, you know, kids, by, you know, all the adolescents, and then of course the adults, to teach them how to use it or to use it better, which, you know, for me is always a bit paternalistic in a way, has always this sound to it. Or do you do, or like Australia, I think, did it now, they're basically just banning from a different age. So I want to get this discussion here. So what do we do? Do we educate? Do we ban? Do we maybe ban the platforms, ban the algorithms? So how do we protect people? And I saw the hand from Mr. Leminski and would want to take him first on that issue of education age. Yes, please.
Well, first of all, thanks for this very important question, because I left this part out from my statement that I'm absolutely convinced that we have to put much more effort in the education, how to use media, how to really reflect on them, and because otherwise the kids of today won't be able to tackle the flood of information, even disinformation as well, in the future. And we at the state have done already a lot by developing programs or websites, offering people the possibility to test themselves, so to see where they are strong on media competence and where they are weak. And where they are weak, they are shown certain offers of private or public institutions, how to improve their techniques, their competence when it comes to media use. And I think that's a way we should go, but in a much broader scale. We scaled it up the last years. We have scaled it up, but there's still a long way to go. Second, to the question of banning social media. I'm a father of four, so I know what I'm talking about. Our oldest is 15 years old, our second child, 12 years old. So they are in touch with all of this. And I can fully understand everyone who says, you know, social media is so dangerous, we should ban it for children under the age of 16. And there are evenings and weekends when I am part of this team who wants to ban it. But at the same time, every regulation has to stand the test, whether it is possible to implement it technically with a generation of digital natives, whether it is possible to enforce it when it comes to the rule of law. I mean, it's a deep interference in the personal rights and the right for information of young people, but also politically. We have to make sure that we don't find regulation which divides the society in those who are young and those who are old, or in those who are digital natives or people who care about, and those who do not care about because they don't need it for their life. And so what I really would urge us in a free democracy, the ban should always be the last resort, the last option. And I don't see many, as many politicians being ready to at least try to develop a regulation between the status of now and the banning. And when I talk to the platforms, I always say, you know, the ban is on the table. It should be an option if they don't move, if they don't get along with their responsibility. But we have to really do the work to find regulation in between, which would stand all those measures, which would stand all those criteria I just mentioned.
I'll come in next. So I want to make clear that education, while I'm a huge proponent of it, of building information literacy, it's not a panacea. It needs to work in conjunction with smart regulation related to oversight and transparency of social media platforms, of advertisers, et cetera, and also support for public media, right? We're having that debate here. I haven't mentioned that at all today, but the fact that President Trump is trying to yank about $1 billion, I think, from public media that has already been allocated for this financial year is deeply troubling to me, because many of your viewers might know that we spend about $1.80, I think, per person per year. It might even be less than that now, on our public media. Compared to what European nations spend for public media that is robust, that informs people, that people turn to in a time of crisis, it's just shameful. That being said, I do think it is incredibly important that we invest in information literacy. And I understand, Max, that it might sound a little bit paternalistic, but it's the same sort of thing about informing people, let's say, you know, we've all gotten the emails from Nigerian princes who are promising us $1 million, right? This is Nigerian princes on a massive targeted scale. And it's not that people don't know, they have been misled by billion-dollar corporations whose job it is to mislead them so that they can continue to increase engagement and increase their profit share, right? And that's where I differ a little bit with Mr. Leminski. A lot of people do think of this as a school-age problem. That's the easiest way to solve it, right? Teach the kids, but what does that do for us today? What, how does that change how voting age adults are behaving? And here's where I think, again, our friends in Eastern Europe have some lessons for us, not just the Finns, who have had a robust information literacy program, as the question from Portugal mentioned, since you know, a couple of decades, but folks in the Czech Republic, in Ukraine and in Georgia have done some really interesting work with information literacy that targets adults. So in the Czech Republic, when I was researching for my book, I heard about efforts to teach especially older adults, so let's say retirees and pensioners, basic skills about how to use an iPad, how to video call your grandchildren. And in there, in those trainings, would be a little bit on information literacy. So they weren't necessarily signing up for a whole information, you know, literacy course, but it was a little bit about how to find trustworthy information on the internet. In Georgia, our friends there in civil society organized infotainment. So they would train a bunch of comedians or musicians or actors in how to spot disinformation. They would send them back to their home cities, towns outside of Tbilisi, and they would then put on a show that would be funded by that organization. And within the material that they were presenting, which would include, you know, popular material, comedy sets, etc., it would include some information about how to, again, navigate today's information environment. This is the sort of thing that we need to think creatively about. And the last thing I'll say on information literacy is that it's important that when we're offering these programs and perhaps when, you know, the EU is funding them or local governments are funding them, that they are partnering with local organizations, because nothing is worse than somebody flying in from a capital, parachuting in and saying to folks in a small town, this is what you should think, and I'm so worldly and smart and wise, and you should listen to me because of that. No, they want to hear that, and this is proven by decades of research as well, they want to hear that from leaders in their community, whether that's a faith leader, whether that is, you know, in the United States, veterans organizations are quite respected. Find those local leaders that might be able to deliver that message to communities that they know and put it in the context that makes sense for them. Very quickly on bans. I'm a big fan of Australia in general and the way they've approached tech regulation. I am not a fan of this ban. As a millennial, practically a digital native, I found a lot of community on the internet as a kid. And I've seen the worst of what the internet has to offer. I know it is difficult, but one of the things that we need to do is empower parents to teach their kids about how to navigate the internet and how to do that safely, empower educators to do that as well. And I think, as Mr. Leminski said, kids are going to find ways around bans, just as, you know, we find ways around other banned content, VPNs and other things. We need the platforms to be upholding their duty of care to young adults. And that's another area for regulation, I think, making sure the onus is on the platforms, not removing, you know, the rights of children to express themselves online, rather than just take that away. We need to put the onus on the platforms and make sure they're not being shown content that is inappropriate for them or harmful for them in other ways. And that's a really big lift, but it's something a lot of regulators have been thinking about for a while, and there's room there for improvement.
Thank you. Giving over to Alexandra. I know Alexandra spends a lot of time in schools as well, being invited as a member of the parliament to many schools and talking to young people about this topic. So when you explain to them how the algorithms work, what is their response?
They say, oh yeah, we know that, but it's so addictive, we just can't put it down. And I think that's a little bit the problem, that we base our ideas on very reasonable ideas, but the psychological mechanisms that these social media companies, who employ thousands and thousands of psychologists who try to figure out how to make us stay more time on the platforms, they are so strong. And the kids say that very openly. You know, very few of adults admit, you know, I was hooked on my phone or spent half an hour and didn't even see it pass. But the kids just say that very clearly and say it's so addictive. You know, we know this is not good information. I mean, they don't even see much really info content. You know, when I went to school, when the European campaign started last year, I went to school, and the first school told the kids told me, you know what we see all day? Accidents with people dying. We see people dying, but you know, by the hundreds. And it's like, it's so shocking. And now I wonder, you know, how can we face that with the idea of media literacy? How do we tell them, well, don't do that? You know, they get that the algorithm puts that content out there, out there, out there again and again. You know, this is not between choosing an article from a serious newspaper or some conspirational theory. This is what the algorithm gives them. And therefore, I think media literacy is super important. Information literacy is super important, but it's more about deconstructing the mechanisms, as Nina said before. You know, the European Commission, they still say, well, people have to learn to check their sources. But people will choose sources that resonate with their emotional needs. And that might not be exactly the most exact information and the best research journalistic content. So I think it's about deconstruction, but this is not going to work if we don't build a social media world or an information ecosystem in which facts have a fair chance. And right now for kids, they don't. And kids are usually pretty media literate, a lot more than people in my generation and older, frankly. As long as the algorithms always put that kind of content out there, it's very hard to defend yourself against that. And there's something on top, and Nina mentioned that briefly. Large language models are being fed by these algorithms with disinformation, as well as by deliberate disinformation campaigns by countries like Russia. And what kids actually do is they use ChatGPT or other AI chatbots. And there's no way with media literacy that you can verify whether that information is correct or not. And 30% of the cases, it is not correct. It's very often incorrect. But that's super hard to understand. So how do we use media literacy there? I think there we need some regulation. Just a very quick thing in the end, on the schools, since Mr. Leminski is here, I mean, schools are overwhelmed by tasks, and it's very hard for schools. I agree schools should do that, but it's very easy to say, you know, there are companies that make each one 100 billion a year. They cause huge societal harms and damage to kids. And then schools in the target countries where these companies don't pay taxes have to find a solution and change people's minds and put that knowledge in there and work with their emotions. And I think Mr. Leminski is very well aware of what's happening to the budget of North Rhine-Westphalia. We just don't have that money. We don't have the teachers. We don't have those capacities. I mean, we can tell teachers they should do that. We can tell schools that they should do it. But it's not happening anytime soon in a scale that we need if we don't get massive funding for this. And this is why we need the digital tax, for example.
And I think getting Mr. Leminski in here again, you also mentioned the digital tax, Digitalabgabe, especially in the regard to press and media. Maybe you can elaborate a bit more, and also about the question here about the, you know, you said the, you know, the social media platforms using this as a business model to make a lot of money. So what can politics do to, you know, interfere, or, you know, at least if it's a business, then, you know, businesses are taxed for a good reason to provide public services. So what? Maybe elaborate a bit more if you can.
Yes, of course. I'd like to do that. As I said in my statement, I think we have to acknowledge the situation that all the budgets for advertisement are going to big tech. In the last years, it's over 50% of the budget went away from the, let's say, classic German media to these big tech firms. And this means that the media landscape changes a lot. And so in order to have still a variety of media outlets, we need to find new sources of refinancing. And at the same time, we see that the big tech, the platforms are using the content being created by others. And so I think that we have to find a way to get them to participate in the financing of these of the creating of these content, and this is by probably not the right way would be a tax, but it would be something like similar. I don't know the English word to be honest for Abgabe, we need something which they have to give, and this has to be designated to strengthen the media landscape in Germany. But I would be also opened to what Alexander Gese just said, if parts of it would be designated to media literacy projects, because I also think that the strongest way to regulate the media landscape would be to have responsible users who know to differentiate between fake news and serious information. And this is the reason why I'm so convinced that although it's a big task or a big challenge, we shouldn't give up in really educating in a broad scale, in a wide scale, the children and youth. But as Nina just said, also I absolutely agree, our programs should always cover the whole society. That's why the things we do not just concentrate on schools, but also on the media literacy of all generations. It's absolutely right to do so. And let me perhaps add one last thing, which I forgot in my last statement. It's about the thing of making sure that young people do not use those programs or apps and others which are not designed for them. We in our media state treaty, we just as a 16 states in Germany, we have convened on the decision that we need to have an age verification system on all. On every cell phone, on every mobile device you are using, and we are going to introduce that in Germany now, and I think that's a very powerful instrument to make sure that it's easier also for parents to make sure that. That we can really enforce age verification.
Thank you. You may be wondering, the audience, why I'm not calling so many named questions. So I have Amelie in the background who kind of is clustering those questions for me. So I know how many are coming roughly from each area. So this is a bit of a, you know, this is clustering involved here. So don't be surprised that you don't hear your name, but your question might be coming up in this kind of clustering. And I want to go in there where Mr. Leminski also mentioned, you know, one of the ways, and you know, or you all mentioned artificial intelligence, because you know, education is one thing, but artificial intelligence, the large language models, are designed to be actually quite superior in terms of, you know, of the human brain, especially in easy tasks and easy information. We all know that when we are using those tools. And so the question we've heard a bit about, you know, how AI is used as a tool to feed or to feed disinformation into platforms. So, but is it possible that also artificial intelligence can also be a tool against that? So if they are working with it, should we fight it with it? Or is that the fire that, you know, that you said we shouldn't use? So is AI maybe the solution against the AI problem?
If you ask Mark Zuckerberg, I'm sure he'd say yes. In fact, as early as 2018 in his first hearing in front of the Senate, I believe he was saying about, you know, AI tools are going to allow us to expand our content moderation. Look, the reality is that humans are smarter than AI, and that AI might eventually reach our level of nuance and understanding and subject matter expertise and cultural lingo, but it's not there yet. And so while I have used AI tools in order to analyze large data sets, particularly of hate speech that I don't want to have to go through and expose myself to, I do a check by hand and I manually code to make sure that it didn't make mistakes. And in one paper I did last year around this time with a similar data set, it was off by like 10% in coding what was hate speech and you know, negative harassing content online. So I don't think we're there yet. And the other thing is we have these models hallucinating so frequently, they can be so easily jailbroke, they can include the, as we've seen with Grok, X's AI tool very recently, influenced by, you know, the people who own the platforms, in some ways more noticeably and overtly than others. I just don't think that solving this problem with a machine-based solution, particularly an industry that is already repeating so many of the mistakes that the early social media industry had, I think that it's going to compound the problem. AI is a tool. We need to use it as a tool, understand its limitations, and have a human in the loop. It might speed things up, but eventually, you know, you will have to run to a brain with human cognition and empathy and understanding of nuance. And unfortunately, you know, AI doesn't have that yet. In terms of detection, there are certainly detection tools for things like deepfakes. I'm pretty bullish on that. You are able to see that stuff more frequently. There's also a lot of movements to digitally watermark any edited audio and video so that people can say, oh, I see how this was edited, and then not necessarily trust things that lack a watermark. But the uptake on those tools hasn't been really expanded yet. And so that's maybe a tomorrow solution, but not a today solution. Ultimately, I really do believe it comes down to individuals and then the power of individuals against platforms in order to ensure that, you know, we can fight back against this stuff. I wouldn't say I'm a doomer on AI. I do use it, but I don't think it's going to solve this crisis the way that some people might hope it does.
Thank you. I'm going to put the chat on the like AI and the link on AI in the chat at the end. So it has a doomsday and a beautiful scenario on it. So that's something to read for the summer break. But I want to get Mr. Leminski in here on that question, because I know that the state here, your state, where you're responsible for this, is actually using AI to identify, and maybe you can explain, the better content, you know, that is to be deleted. So what is your experience with that?
Yeah, you are right. Our agencies, which are responsible for enforcing DSA and other pieces of regulation, they have developed a technique using AI to detect more cases like Nina just described. But Nina's absolutely right that we still have to, in the end, go through it hand by hand, because the AI still makes failures. There are still failures. So, but what we do is we can detect much more cases. And the other 15 states in Germany, they have taken this technique or this technology as well. Our Belgian neighbors, they have also asked to use it. And I know of other European countries being interested in it as well. It's called KIWI. That's the acronym to it. And this is the reason, actually, why the German state agencies are those who deliver the most cases when it comes to the European level, when it comes to enforcing DSA and other regulation. And that shows that AI can be helpful, can be used also for the good side, but we still have to follow up. And that's what we do, is not just to detect and to publish, but also to give it to the law enforcement and then really identify those people doing it, and in the end, being in front of their door, knocking the door, telling them, we know what you're doing. And of course, this means that you have to put in a lot of resources. And that's what we did, that's what we have done the last years, personnel, but also financing. And we also train the technology, new languages, Arabic now and other languages, so that it really can identify and detect more cases.
Thank you. We have 5 minutes left. So Alexander, you will be next. Just wanted to announce how I want to end with you all, and we're going to do after Alexander do a final round on this. This is the question that you all kind of referred to, is that, you know, we have strong rules in Europe and we need to defend them against especially what's happening in the US and what Trump is doing. So I want to do a round with you at the end, and you can already start thinking about you know, specifically saying what you personally can do and what you're doing and what the people in this room, we are still 800, there are 400, 500, 600 on YouTube as well. So what can people actually do if they want to defend the rules we have against, you know, what the US is trying, what the Trump administration is trying to do? But Alexandra, on AI, and then I'm going to open the round to this final question.
Yeah, just briefly on AI, I think these detection artificial intelligence programs are great, absolutely, but they do need human oversight, as has been said. But the basic, the interesting thing about the detection instrument of the North Rhine-Westphalia State Media Oversight Authority is that they did it themselves, basically. You know, it's not something they bought in the US, but it's built in Germany or in Europe, at least, exactly to match the needs of that authority. And that is the interesting point, because the problem with AI in general is when you speak about AI, what we mostly mean is a handful of large language models built by exactly the same people that build social media and that control social media. And as you said, Nina Zuckerberg said in the US Congress, yeah, we will combat hate speech and whatever with artificial intelligence in the European Parliament. I remember an audition where somebody from the University of Munich, the Technical University, is famously funded heavily by Facebook, said, yeah, against hate speech, we're just going to produce a lot of counter speech with artificial intelligence. And, you know, imagine this internet where, you know, the bots are talking to the bots. And why should we as humans engage in this fight between bots? This totally doesn't make sense. It only makes sense for the advertising company that Facebook is, not for anybody of us. So the problem with artificial intelligence is that it's the same people who control artificial intelligence and who control social media, and their interest is not at all keeping us safe. Their interest is taking money out of Europe, taking money out of us by keeping us riveted. So that's the problem. That brings me to another topic that's very dear to my heart, and I'm working on a European dialogue, that is European digital sovereignty. So what we should do in Europe is build our own tech instruments, build our own digital infrastructure, and that also means build our own artificial intelligence that whose aim, principal aim, is not to increase our screen time, but to really build solutions that help us with our lives.
And there are many questions about that as well, actually, and we haven't covered them at all, about, you know, what is the alternative in terms of tech. And we're going to do another webinar on that, I think, because I think that's another very crucial point. So I want to, because we're running out of time, giving you 1 minute each, Nina, Mr. Leminski, Alexandra, and then we are finishing up. Nina.
Yeah, so I think in terms of what people can do, these platforms are not immune to pressure. We have seen pressure campaigns from users of these platforms amount to change before. So don't feel disempowered just because they have powerful allies. As Mr. Leminski said, I believe in his opening remarks, Europe is a powerful market for these companies. So make your voices heard. And one way that you can do that, in addition to kind of expressing your displeasure, calling your legislators to make sure that they're enforcing legislation, you can also report content that you see, right? A lot of these AI systems that they have are triggered when a lot of people are reporting similar content, whether that content is hate speech or something violent or disinformative, right? So don't be a passive online bystander, be an active online bystander and communicate to these services that you're using, that are using you, that are monetizing your behavior. They work for you. You are not the product, right? Let's flip that script. And I think if we all start to do that, then we might see a more responsive tech landscape soon.
Mr. Leminski.
Well, first of all, I totally agree to what Nina just said. And I would like to add the whole part of research, because what we are now going to introduce into the DSA, or we have introduced already, is the possibility to find more data on how these platforms work. And of course, first of all, they have to give these data. I'm hoping that the European Union will enforce this part as well. But as soon as we have this data, we can know more, but we have to use it and also do research on it and also publish it so that we have a solid base to judge the behavior of those platforms and to find then ways to discuss it in public and, of course, develop regulation on it as well. And for doing so, we have to keep that issue in the public by events like tonight. We have to make it an issue, not leave it up to those platforms, and be self-confident that we are one of the most attractive markets all over the world in Europe. And this means that there is a very, very strong possibility for us, an opportunity to have a strong voice on this development worldwide.
Thank you, Alexander Gitte.
Yeah, first thing, sign the petition, Freedom for Facts. This is how you can put pressure on politicians, on the European Commission, share that. There's a brief explanation. So share that knowledge, do something, sign the petition, and tell people about how important that is and how the mechanisms work. It's explained there. Put pressure on politicians. This is a problem that politicians can't fix. They just need to feel the pressure from the public opinion that this is what you want us to do. You know, it's that we already have a legal basis. We have a piece of legislation. We can just do it, put pressure, talk about it, talk to your members of parliament, bring this topic up very regularly. This is a business model of a few companies, and we can change that very, very easily. It's not God-given. It's not nature. We can change it, and this is the right moment to do it. And on an individual level, when we have alternative platforms, like, for example, Mastodon and Blue Sky for X, go to them, use them, or Ecosia instead of Google. There's more coming up, and as soon as these alternative platforms come up, there's some European version of Blue Sky coming. Support them just simply by using their services.
Thank you so much. Thank you all. Put all the links you gave me and sent me in different directions, put them all in the chat. I was going to send them with a follow-up email tomorrow or the day after with the recordings, because that's the end. It was really exciting. It was an excellent discussion. Thank you all for so many questions. We're going to keep that. You know, this, I think there was a third webinar kind of on this area or just half year. So we're going to keep on. We're going to keep the pressure. Thanks to all of you. Thanks to all of you in the audience. And this was the last Europe Calling webinar before the summer. So we're going into the summer break. If nothing major happens, it happens all the time, but I hope it will be a summer break at some point. And then we'll see each other again, probably in August, end of August, with our next installment of Europe Calling. Thank you all very much. Thank you very much to the interpreters as well for your excellent job, and have you all a very nice evening, and best of luck and safety for all of you. Bye-bye.